Chapter 31. The Frobishers finally leave room 232 at 6:15, about an hour after the women have decided silently that the plan is not going to work and sunk into despondency. Jasmine has been tidying the office behind the front desk, issuing vague platitudes at Michelle's endless conversations about the unfairness of the rota system while she watches for movement in the foyer. Sam and Nisha wait in silence in the stuffy little changing room, ignoring the incurious glances of the staff coming in to get things from their lockers or change to go home. They are just anonymous staff to any casual passerby, neither worth talking to nor acknowledging. The two women sit in silence, each locked in her thoughts. Nisha finds herself irritated by Sam's droopy face, the air she carries of someone defeated by life. And then her phone pings, breaking into her thoughts. She stares at the screen, suddenly alert. They're moving. Nisha stares at her phone as another text comes through. "Oh, my God," she says, hardly able to believe what she's reading. "She's not wearing the shoes." "Really?" says Sam hopefully. "It's raining," says Nisha. "It's actually raining, thank you, Lord." She is already on her feet. "Okay, remember what we said. You follow them out, make sure they're gone, and I'll run up and get the shoes." Nisha is wearing a dark shirt and trousers so that she can pass either for hotel staff, if wearing her lanyard, or a particularly boringly dressed guest, if she tucks it into her pocket. Jasmine has given her a newly programmed guest key, and her heart is thumping against her ribcage. This is it. She is going to have the shoes back, finally. She and Sam walk in silence along the corridor until they reach the side entrance and Sam heads out, her phone pressed to her ear as Jasmine instructs her as to which direction they went. "Head right towards Regent Street. She's still in the red suit. No overcoat. Damn fool must be freezing." Nisha walks to the elevator and presses the button for the second floor. She stares at her feet in Sam's flat black shoes as it moves slowly upwards and turns the key card over and over in her hand. This is it. The elevator arrives at the second floor, the doors open, and she steps out. Her mind is buzzing, a surge of anticipatory triumph pulsing through her veins. 20 steps, 10 steps, and they will be hers. And there is Ari, talking to two men in suits halfway down the corridor. She swivels on her heel, ducks quickly back into the lift and stands with her finger on the door open button, trying to figure out what to do. She moves her head forward tentatively to check that it really is him, then ducks back. He is showing one of them something on a piece of paper, just standing there, casually talking, like he has nowhere to go, nowhere else to be. She cannot reach the room without walking past him, but she is not confident she will be invisible a second time. She exits the lift and sidesteps into the service cupboard, which has been left open by one of the housekeepers. Standing beside the shelves of towels and sheets, she texts Jasmine. "Can't get into room. Ari is there." Jasmine's reply is immediate. "Don't panic. I'll come and get them." Another message follows. "We've got this. Just breathe." There is something unexpectedly soothing about tailing someone through the streets of London, Sam thinks, as she weaves in and out of the crowds milling down Regent Street. It takes all of her focus to keep track of the Frobishers, the bright red of Liz's suit glowing, her pace measured as she pauses every few feet to point at shop windows. Sam stays 30 feet behind, the hood of her anorak over her head against the fine rain, her breath coming in steam puffs in the cold, feeling an odd sense of gratitude that she is doing something achievable, that the utter concentration it requires means there is no room in her head for anything else. And Liz Frobisher is clearly enjoying herself. She walks with a faint swagger, as if expecting to be admired, the winner of the Global Cat Foundation Charity Shop Award, reaching up a hand periodically to smooth her hair or check her makeup in a window. Darren Frobisher, in contrast, looks sullen and fed up, surreptitiously checking his phone and visibly sighing every time she stops. Sam's phone rings. She answers immediately. Well, it's nice to know you're still alive. Sam watches as the Frobishers continue up Regent Street, are briefly lost between a large group of teenagers, then appear again. What is it, Mum?
What is it? That's a lovely greeting, I must say. You didn't find the hymns.
What?
Your father's now looking at For Those in Peril on the Sea. He says all the others are too religious. I said it's awfully gloomy. It makes me seasick to think about it.
I'm kind of in the middle of something right now. Can I call you back?
And it's so patriarchal. All those hymns are.
Her mother starts to sing.
Eternal Father, strong to save, whose arm has bound the restless wave.
I mean, honestly, you might as well call on the Incredible Hulk, though he's gone into a terrible sulk because I said so.
The couple pauses while they have some kind of conversation, head to head. Darren points eastwards, perhaps towards Chinatown, and pulls a face. Liz holds up a hand, as if she might be noticing the rain.
Anyway, you're obviously not going to help with the hymns, so I simply want to know when you're coming to help sort the house out. It's really in a terrible state. We have a blockage in the downstairs loo, which has been there for days. Your father feels quite abandoned. I don't know what's going on with you, but...
I can't do this now, Mum.
And I don't like him going in the upstairs loo because he'll probably block that one too. You know what happened after he had those prunes?
Mum, I'll call you back.
But when...
Sam ends the call and ducks into a shop entrance, fearful that the couple might see her. Whatever they're talking about has clearly made Darren even less delighted. They stand in heated discussion for a few moments, the crowds of shoppers and commuters surging around them. And then their voices start to lift, so that Sam can hear snatches of it, carried on the breeze in spite of the roar of the traffic.
Well, I didn't know it would be this cold, did I? I'm starving, Liz, and it's raining. I don't want to walk all the way back to...
Sam cannot make out the rest of it, but she sees Liz gesticulating and Darren raising his arms in a gesture of exasperation. As she watches, Liz turns and begins to walk towards her. Sam swivels in the doorway and sees that both are now walking back in the direction of the hotel, still arguing. She glances down at her phone and starts to punch in Nisha's number, just as the phone screen goes dead. Her heart briefly stops. She stares in disbelief. She's out of charge. With everything going on, she had forgotten to charge the bloody phone. Sam looks up. They are already some 20 meters ahead of her, walking back briskly towards the Bentley Hotel, Darren shaking his head at something Liz had said. Oh God, oh God. They had not planned for this. There is nothing else for it. Sam flips her hood up over her head and begins to run. Jasmine is just walking towards the lift when she hears Frederick, the hotel manager, behind her, his voice lifting above the low hum of the lobby.
Ah, Jasmine, just the person.
He is standing at the reception desk and beckons her over. Jasmine curses under her breath and turns around, a smile already plastered across her face.
Wine spillage in 217. The sheets need replacing. Can you get onto it immediately? They're waiting in the room.
She opens her mouth to explain that she is not working this shift, but realizes she cannot without explaining what she is doing there. She nods instead, says, of course, and sets off at a brisk pace to the second floor. She texts Nisha as soon as she is outside. Sorry, diversion. Give me 5, kiss. It takes Sam 7 minutes to reach the hotel, pushing past people on the busy street, dodging umbrella spokes, apologizing when some curse at her, her chest heaving from the unexpected exercise. She runs into the side entrance and down the narrow corridor, skidding into the little changing room. A man sits on the bench, polishing a pair of shiny black lace-up shoes.
Jasmine, she says breathlessly.
He shakes his head. She runs along the narrow corridor, yelling Jasmine's name so that a couple of housekeepers turn to look at her, but nobody answers. Swearing under her breath, Sam stops and tries to think clearly. Jasmine could be anywhere in this hotel. It's a rabbit warren. The foyer. Jasmine will be in the foyer. Of course she will. She runs back along the corridor, trying to remember where the service lift is.
She spies it at the far end and punches the button, jiggling with anxiety as it makes its way sedately down from the fourth floor. The doors slide open, agonizingly slowly. She jabs the button marked G once, twice, three times. "Oh, come on," she says aloud as the rickety lift thinks about it, then finally acquiesces grudgingly, like a grumpy elderly relative, and judders its way upwards. Nisha waits in the linen cupboard, listening to Ari still talking in the corridor, his deep, flat voice occasionally lifting as he discusses something she cannot make out. Oh, but she's so close. Her whole body is alive with tension, every muscle tensed for the sound of him moving. "It's fine," she tells herself. "Jasmine will be here in a minute. Just breathe." And then finally, after several decades have passed, she hears muffled footsteps on the carpet. They come towards her, so she stands very still, huddled against the shelves with her back to the door, some part of her still waiting for it to be thrown open, for him to find her. And then the footsteps recede, and she is holding her breath, turning cautiously to open the door and peer out. There is Ari's back, broad and solid in its dark suit, disappearing down the corridor. Ari apparently deep in conversation with whoever is talking into his earpiece. She looks in the other direction, and the two men he had been speaking to are walking down the corridor the other way, towards the elevator. Nisha closes her eyes and breathes, trying to ignore the trembling in her fingers, and then, once she is sure of the silence, she straightens her shoulders, walks out of the cupboard and briskly down the corridor to 232, looking like the kind of woman who has every right to be there. She holds her key card against the door, and it clicks with a satisfying sound. Finally, she is in. Sam skids through the revolving doors of the entrance, just in time to see Jasmine's back disappearing through the doors at the end of the lobby. She slows her pace to a brisk walk as she crosses the expanse of marble, trying to look unobtrusive, then breaks into a run on the other side of the doors.
"Jasmine!"
she yells, and Jasmine turns, her hand to her chest.
"Did she get the shoes?"
"I don't know. One of her husband's goons was standing in the corridor. I was meant to go and get them for her, but I've got to change some sheets." Just then her phone pings. She looks up at Sam and beams.
"Yes, she's in." "No, no, no. They're heading back."
"What?"
"The Frobishers. They had a row and they're coming back for her coat. Tell her to get out of there."
"Damn it, stupid woman. It was obvious she'd be too cold in that suit," Jasmine mutters, then punches out a text to Nisha. "Get out! They're coming back!"
Nisha scans the room, her breath coming in short bursts, Liz Frobisher's pungent, oversweet perfume still hanging in the air. The shoes are here, damn it. They must be here. She spies the suitcase on the case stand and flings open the top, rifling carefully through it with her fingertips, trying not to consider the ick factor involved in touching someone else's underclothes. Nothing. She opens the wardrobe door. They are not there either. She stands, thinking. Liz Frobisher wasn't wearing the shoes. Jasmine had been certain, and Sam would have messaged them. She was following the couple after all. Nisha lifts the valance so she can peer under the bed in case they have been kicked underneath. She considers the possibility that Liz Frobisher has taken them with her to put on at her destination, and curses. Would anyone take a pair of high heels just to eat a Chinese? Finally, she ducks her head into the bathroom and lets out a gasp of relief. There they are, lying on the tiled floor, their red soles glowing against the marble. The sight of them causes a bolt of electricity to shoot through her, as if all her nerve endings are suddenly alive. She stoops and grabs the shoes and lets out a breath she hadn't known she has been holding.
Yes!
And then her phone buzzes. She looks down. Get out! They're coming back! Nisha does a 360-degree scan of the room, checking that everything is straight, and hurries to the door. She has her hand on the handle when she hears the voices in the corridor.
That's because I don't go out dressed like I'm going to a summer party in early December. Jesus.
Why do you have to be so nasty? Do you actually want me to get a cold?
No, Liz, I just want my dinner. You know how I get if I don't eat? And you could have just brought the coat with you and saved us the bother of coming all the way back. The voices stop outside the door. Nisha stares at it in horror. She gazes around the room, and then, with a click, the door begins to open. She's not answering. Maybe she's coming back down in the lift. There's no reception in it, mutters Sam, and Jasmine nods. They stand in the corner of the foyer, two people who apparently don't know each other, their eyes trained dumbly on the lift. Every time it opens, it disgorges a handful of guests, but no Nisha. And then her phone buzzes. I'm in the room. They're back. Get me out. Jasmine types furiously, Sam gazing over her shoulder. What do you mean they're in the room? Where are you? Under the bed. They're having an argument. Oh my days, murmurs Jasmine, staring in horror at the screen. What do we do? Says Sam. Stay calm, says Jasmine. If they're coming back for her coat, they'll go again in a minute. It's all going to be fine. She says this twice, as if to reassure herself. They're just coming back for her coat, right? Yes, says Sam. Yes, you're right. It's all going to be fine. Nisha lies under the queen-sized bed, every cell of her body taut with horror. She and Jasmine always wheel the beds to the side to vacuum underneath, but whoever does the second floor clearly takes no such trouble. There are dust bunnies to each side of her, strands of stranger's hair, skin cells, a whole miasma of disgusting, microscopic bodily leftovers, and she is lying right in it. The thought of it makes her want to sob aloud. She cannot look to the right or left of her, because then she sees what she is lying amid, and it makes her want to retch. So she stays very still, eyes screwed shut, hands across her belly so that as little skin as possible is actually touching the floor. We're not late for dinner. We didn't have a bloody booking, Darren, because you couldn't be bothered to make one as per usual. The only thing we're late for is you wanting to stuff your fat face again. Footsteps walk around the bed. Is this because you wanted to go to your mum's? Jesus! I like going to my mum's on a Sunday. Why is that such a problem for you? You just go there because she runs round after you and doesn't let you lift a finger? No wonder you're so useless at home. Just go, thinks Nisha. Just go and have your embarrassing row at a restaurant. Please just get out of this room. You know what? I don't feel like going out anymore. I'm ordering room service. What? Liz Frobisher's voice is disbelieving. You heard? Nisha winces as a weight lands on the bed on top of her. The base of the bed is now less than an inch from her nose. She hears Darren, because it must be Darren, pick up the remote control and switch on the hotel television. Some kind of football match commentary blares into the room. So you're just going to stay here and leave me to eat by myself? You can do what you want. Your idea to come here. You sort yourself out. My sister was right about you. Oh, your sister. Great, let's bring her into it. Something is tickling Nisha's nose. Perhaps some dust particle dislodged by the movement of Darren's bulk. She brings her hand up to her nose and squeezes it tight. She is going to sneeze. Oh, God. She can't stop it. Nisha thinks she may explode. It's unstoppable. At the exact moment she lets out a loud sneeze, the room suddenly erupts in sound. Goal! A tremendous goal there from Kane! The keeper really didn't stand a chance, blares the television commentator, and the noise begins to subside. Nisha's eyes are watering. She thinks she may scream. Above her, Darren shifts his weight, and she hears the sound of the hotel phone being lifted from the bedside table. You're really just going to stay here? Yeah, says Darren. It's too cold out. Let's just eat something. I want to go out. We never go out anywhere nice. We went out last Saturday. Yeah, but that was with your brother. Nisha tries to separate herself from her body, the way she has heard people talk about. She focuses on her breathing, then realizes that when she breathes deeply, she is more likely to be inhaling the detritus under this bed. She screws her eyes shut and clamps a hand over her mouth. There are footsteps, then nothing but the televised crowd noise of the football. Nisha opens her eyes and hears muffled sobbing coming from the easy chair in the corner of the room. The bed above her shifts slightly, and she sees Darren's feet land on the carpeted floor beside her head. There is a hole in his right sock, which reveals a coin of pale heel. Are you crying?
Go away!
A long silence. More muffled sobbing.
I just want this to be my special day. I won a prize, Darren. I was all excited and now you've ruined everything.
A sigh. Nothing's ruined. Come on. Come here. I'm just hungry. Suddenly, her phone flashes up a message. Are you out? No, she types back. Are they going out? I don't know. I'm literally going to die under this bed. Help. There are three pulsing dots, then silence. She imagines Jasmine and Sam downstairs, trying to work out what to do. Jasmine will think of something. She has to. All right, babe, we'll go out. Put your coat on. She hears him climb into his own jacket, the slide of an arm into a sleeve, the rattle of keys. Did I put my wallet on the side? Go, she thinks. Just go eat, for God's sakes. And then Liz's sorrowful voice.
I don't want to go out anymore.
Nisha's eyes widen. Is this bitch kidding?
You've spoiled it.
Darren's voice bears the conciliatory tone of a man who has dealt with many, many such exchanges. Oh, don't cry, babe. You know I can't stand it when you cry. Some muffled exchanges she can't make out. Come here. Come sit on the bed with me. We'll have a cuddle. Nisha holds her breath, then winces as the bed creaks slightly under the weight of what may be two people. Come here, my little baby boo. Come on. The sniffing stops. Is that? Oh my God. No. The hairs on the back of her neck stand up on end. She hears the sound of kissing.
You never call me that anymore.
My baby boo, you look gorgeous in that suit. Really gorgeous.
You're just saying that.
You look way tastier than a plate of crispy duck. There is a reluctant giggle. Oh, God, please no. No, no, no. Ooh, my favourite bra. You know I like that one. The sound of more kissing, more giggling, and then a soft moan, and then a louder, masculine one. Nisha types again, her fingers jabbing with silent urgency. Jesus, get me out of here now! Nisha has experienced many states of misery this last month, but all the other things that have happened were merely hors d'oeuvres. She has hit her own personal nadir. It is as if every one of her worst nightmares has been made flesh, in the form of the lumpy couple getting jiggy a matter of inches from her face. She has entered a new mental space, in which it requires every ounce of focus she has just to breathe without screaming, to stay here a second longer without clawing and shrieking her way out across the disgusting carpet. She closes her eyes and tries to think about Ray, but bringing his lovely face into this disgusting farrago is wrong, and she lies there instead, one hand over her mouth, trying to disengage from the noises above her. This is it, she thinks. This is how I die. They will slump into a post-sex coma. I will be stuck here all night, and they will find my tortured corpse the next time one of the second-floor maids decides it's not beneath them to actually move a fucking piece of furniture and vacuum underneath this bed. Every time she thinks she cannot bear a moment longer, she forges her way past. One nightmarish second at a time. And then Darren decides to really go for it. The bed starts to move, the slats buckling above her so that they are repeatedly touching her face, The gasps and shrieks of pleasure become louder. Nisha has begun to lose control. She is shaking. Her mind has gone blank. This is too much. It is unbearable. This is... Sam and Jasmine are at the end of the corridor on the second floor. They are standing a few feet away from each other. Jasmine by the housekeeping trolley, Sam's hood up over her head, and Jasmine is quietly conveying the text messages coming through on her phone, which is resting on a pile of towels. Jasmine picks up the phone and types tentatively, "Are you okay?"
"No, I am not okay. They are actually having sex on top of me."
Jasmine's eyes widen in horror. She relays this to Sam and lets out a nervous laugh. They lean towards the door of room 232, and in the silence they can just make out the sounds, the noises that would make a bystander's toes curl at the best of times. "She will die," says Jasmine, nodding as she straightens up. "She is actually going to die." The phone dings again. "All the dust, I'm going to sneeze."
"No, baby," Jasmine mutters, typing. "Do not sneeze, do not sneeze."
"I'm having a panic attack." The phone keeps pinging. "Can't breathe, help me."
"What are we going to do?"
Jasmine hisses, anguished. Sam cannot bear it any longer. She flaps her hands, trying to think. She closes her eyes, then opens them and scoots back down the corridor until she spies what she's looking for. She glances back at Jasmine, slips her Marks & Spencer navy court shoe from her foot, and whacks the fire alarm button with it, 2-3 times, until the glass shatters. Then she slams the button with the heel of her hand. The noise is immediate and ear-splitting.
"What the hell are you doing?"
yells Jasmine.
"Run,"
says Sam, and bolts towards the fire escape. Chapter 32. The recorded message booms into every one of the Bentley Hotel's 310 bedrooms. "Please do not panic. The fire alarm has been triggered. Please make your way to the nearest fire exit." Darren, halted at what might possibly be an inopportune moment, takes a second longer to comprehend what is happening than Liz does. She is already out of bed, her bare feet on the floor.
"Fire? Darren, there's a fire? A fire?"
he says, breathing hard.
"It will be a false alarm."
"I can hear people going down the corridor. Darren, get up. We have to go."
"I don't believe this."
Darren's feet, still in his socks, land on the floor beside Nisha's head. She is frozen, deafened by the noise. She fumbles for her shoes by her right thigh and winds her fingers into the straps. She can hear the Frobishers struggling into their clothes, bickering, gathering their things, the urgent voices and footsteps outside in the corridor, and over it all the piercing, intermittent ring of the fire alarm.
"Bag? Where's my handbag?" "We'll get downstairs and it'll stop, babe. Where are the shoes?"
"Don't worry about the bloody shoes, just get your..."
"Darren, everyone is leaving the hotel. Come on!"
She hears the panic in Liz Frobisher's voice. Some distant part of her wonders if this fire is real, whether she will be able to get out in time or burn here, under the bed, and be found in the aftermath, like some human relic from Pompeii. She hears the click of the hotel door opening, the abrupt noise of 100 people emerging from their rooms, bleary and confused, a baby crying. Then the door closes and the noise becomes muffled again. There is a brief lull. Nisha waits a moment, then wriggles out from under the bed, coughing and brushing dust from her clothes, her eyes watering as she gags. The photograph. She mustn't forget the photograph. She whips out the printed screenshot, places it on the bedside table, then tiptoes to the door, peers out and, clutching the shoes to her chest, is instantly swept into the moving river of anxious guests heading for the fire escape stairs, no longer even caring if she is about to be consumed by flames. It has to be a better fate than remaining in that room. Sam and Jasmine huddle by the back entrance, where staff are emerging in small clumps, still unsure whether they should be leaving their posts. Some have lit cigarettes, blind to the irony, and a series of white-jacketed chefs stand in a shivering huddle, bemoaning ruined soufflés, burnt fish portions, and the wrath of the maitre d'.
She's not answering any texts. Do you think we should call?
Maybe give it another 5 minutes, just in case.
I'll call Alex. Maybe he knows.
Sam's heart is beating hard. She feels elated and terrified. She did this. She created this epic state of chaos and havoc.
She hears the alarm ringing in the air, the voices of senior managers as they try to establish where the fire is.
The hotel is emptying, hundreds of people spilling out of the main entrance onto the pavement, parents trying to shepherd crying children, jet-lagged tourists blinking in the sodium light.
Her life has turned to chaos, and now she is creating it herself. She has stopped this enormous machine with one hand. Over the shrill noise, she can see Jasmine talking urgently into the phone, her hand pressed against her other ear. Around her, the street is coming to a halt as guests, some in dressing gowns, some in hastily grabbed coats, start to spread into the road, the taxi horns blaring as they navigate in the dark around them.
Sam watches it all, disbelieving, and finds that something strange is happening. A bubble of something unfamiliar is rising in her chest, pushing upwards so that she cannot control it. Sam begins to laugh. She leans her head back against the wall, feeling the cold of the brick against her scalp, the rough texture against her hands, and she starts to laugh at the insane chaos of it all. Sam laughs and laughs until she's crying, tears leaking from her eyes, clutching her sides. And she sees Jasmine staring at her, frowning in disbelief, and this makes her laugh even more.
"Have you lost your mind?"
Jasmine says, shoving her phone into her pocket. Sam wipes at her eyes and nods, still laughing.
"Maybe, yes. Yes, I think maybe I have."
Nisha makes her way along the corridor in the thick of the throng, slowed at the entrance to the emergency stairs as the crowd begins to bottleneck at the fire door. A large group of young people are laughing and joking, and behind her, an elderly couple complain about the noise, holding crepey hands to their ears. She clasps the shoes to her chest, unable to believe she has made it. She finally has them. She watches the crowd funnel slowly down the narrow stairway and glances behind her just to see if Jasmine or Sam are nearby. And it is then that she sees him. Ari. His eyes fix on the shoes in front of her, and then his gaze lifts to her face and betrays a flicker of shock when he realizes who he's looking at. Almost immediately, he is pushing his way forward through the protesting guests towards her. Nisha's heart stops. She shoves her way through the door into the stairwell, jostling in and out of the people slowly descending the stairs, knowing he will be right behind her.
"Watch it, you nearly had me over."
Nisha has no breath to apologize. It is lodged somewhere in her chest. She shoves her way through, stumbles down 3 steps, hearing the exclamations behind her that mean Ari is doing the same thing. She makes a swift calculation and ducks out of the exit on the 1st floor, wincing as someone elbows her hard in the chest. They are packed so closely together that she can smell other people's scents, feel their vague panic. She squeezes between 2 large men in suits and then she is off, pushing against the current of people forcing their way to the fire escape and finally running for the service elevator. The 1st rule of fire regulations is don't use the elevator, but Nisha nips inside and slams the button to the ground floor, just in time to see Ari's face register hers as the doors close against him. She yells, without knowing what she's yelling, and suddenly the elevator lurches into life, heading slowly downwards. He will be talking to his men. How many will there be? Where will he go? The doors open again on the ground floor, and she is running through the packed foyer until she sees the door of the restaurant. She pushes through it, then sprints along the side of the room, which is almost empty, bar a few perturbed guests, arguing with the waiting staff about wanting their coats, and then she has reached the kitchens. Sunday night, and normally the kitchens of the Bentley are a world of noise, of clattering pans and steam and things frying at impossible temperatures. Men in white with harassed expressions yell at each other, wipe smears from plates with linen cloths as the doors open and close with waiters ferrying dishes backwards and forwards. Now, there's just a handful of kitchen staff gathering belongings, the smell of food burning as they head to the service door. She spies him.
Alex!
He turns, perhaps sees something in her expression, because he begins to jog towards her.
He's after me! Help!
She yells, glancing behind her, and without hesitating, he grabs her elbow, pushing her along past the prep station. In here, he says, punching a code into the panel beside the metallic door, and then they're in the refrigerator room, and he has pulled the heavy door shut behind them, shepherding her through the plastic sheeting towards the back. The lights come on automatically with their movement, and she glances around her at the huge trays of meat, the hanging carcasses lining the tiled walls, the shelves of vegetables and industrial cartons of milk. Over there, he points, end of the racks. She ducks where he says, behind an endless stack of eggs, and they wedge themselves behind a rack of tall stainless steel canisters so that they cannot be seen. It is silent in here, bar the industrial hum of the refrigeration unit. She is breathing hard, and her heartbeat thumps in her ears as the outside din fades. Every time she closes her eyes, she sees Ari, the shock and determination on his face as he pursues her. You got them, Alex says. She looks down, sees she is still holding the shoes, nods silently at him, holding them tighter to her, suddenly realizing that she really does have them. The alarm continues to shriek outside, but in here the siren is muffled, and her nerves slowly stop jangling. He smiles, his face inches from hers, and she smiles back, more nervously. Some part of her still believes Ari will come bursting in and rip the shoes from her. He won't get in, he says, as if reading her mind. He would need the code to open the door. Is there really a fire?
No.
Your friend Sam rang the fire alarm. Jasmine told me.
Sam?
She is incredulous. She glances down at her phone, seeing the stream of missed calls and text messages.
Jasmine says you were having a panic attack, and she took an executive decision.
He reaches up to move a lock of hair from her face.
Are you okay? What happened?
You won't believe me if I told you. He smiles. His arm is alongside her head, his palm resting on the wall, and she can see the sinews of his forearms, the tiny blonde hairs lifting in the cold air. She is suddenly aware of the temperature now she has stopped moving. How long do you think we'll have to stay here?
Until everyone comes back.
You don't think we should sneak out now, while they're all outside? He pulls a face.
It could be a little tricky. This door does not open from inside.
What? Faulty mechanism. They never fix anything back of house. It's fine. Everyone will be back in 20 minutes tops. We are not going to freeze to death.
I might.
Nisha is already regretting just wearing the black blouse and trousers. There is no protection against the cold in here. She wraps her arms around herself, beginning to shiver. He sees her discomfort and wrestles off his chef's jacket, placing it around her shoulders and buttoning it under her chin.
Better?
A little. He is so close to her. She can smell the scent of him, the vague aroma of good things cooking, the citrusy smell of soap underneath. She has a sudden memory of his kiss, the way she had felt like she wanted to melt into him and forget everything around her. Here, he says, and places his arms around her, pulling her into his chest. She can feel the warmth of his body through his t-shirt, and as she rests her head against him, she can just make out the beating of his heart. She closes her eyes, hearing the distant sound of doors, the endless drone of the alarm. He is the calmest person she has ever met, and this soothes her. It is all going to be okay. She is safe here. Ari will not find her. She has the shoes. But in the near silence above the hum of the refrigerator, she becomes aware of his heartbeat. Surely it's faster than a regular heartbeat. Her hands are cold, and he takes one in his own and brings it to his lips, breathing warm air onto it, closing his fingers around it to warm her up. The heartbeat speeds up a little. Nisha slides her other hand under his t-shirt. "For warmth," she murmurs, and his heartbeat speeds up a little more. And something in her shifts. She lifts her face and he is looking straight at her, and something has gone a little blurry between them. "It's so cold in here," she says quietly. A pause. And then her lips are on his and his hands are in her hair and they are up against the rack, their kisses hot and endless, his hands gripping her to him, and Nisha has forgotten about the temperature completely. The door is opened 28 minutes later, the alarm silenced, and the staff are finally filing back in, muttering and joking, making their way to their stations. Nisha and Alex are waiting beside the door, she's still wearing his chef's white jacket over her shoulders, their expression suspiciously blank. Andre opens it and stares at the two people in the doorway. "I was keeping her warm," says Alex, when he keeps staring. "Right," says Andre. They are halfway down the side alley before they realize Alex has left his belt and Nisha has the remnants of two broken eggs sliding down her back. They leave the hotel through a side exit from a large storeroom for banqueting chairs and tables, somehow emerging onto an alleyway on the other side of the hotel, far from the crowds and chaos. They walk the last half mile, arm in arm, to Jasmine's apartment, barely speaking, but the lengthy silences do not make Nisha feel anxious or uneasy. Perhaps for the first time in her life, she experiences a deep peace, a calm that feels drugged, almost alien to her. Her whole body is charged, hyper-aware of the man walking beside her, but at the same time honeyed and completely relaxed. Alex has the shoes stashed safely in his backpack, which is slung over one shoulder. He walks swiftly through the night streets, his stride matching hers, and she speaks only to give him directions. "We need to turn here," or "It's just by that corner," and occasionally he squeezes her slightly to him. It is a pleasurable thing, that squeeze. Not possessive, just comforting, a reminder of his presence. It also sporadically prompts an echo of their half hour in the refrigeration room, and when she thinks of it, something at the core of her turns molten and liquid. "So this is what it feels like." There is something almost sad about it, the revelation of what she has normalized for the last 20 years, the way she had assumed she was in something equal, respectful, when everything Carl had done had actually reinforced his basic disrespect. He had admired her, yes, desired her, often, but loved her, no. She wasn't sure he was capable of that emotion. "Stay with me," Alex had murmured, his eyes inches from hers, and in that raw moment she knew she had spent half her life with a man who had failed to connect with her at all. It wasn't even in his vocabulary. "I have been a possession," she thinks. "I have been an object, a prize, an appendage, then an inconvenience." She closes her eyes, wishing away the shame and sadness that come with understanding.
"She's here!"
Jasmine throws open the door, letting out a warm burst of scented air, and as she steps inside, Nisha can see that Sam, Andrea, and Grace are waiting in the kitchen, their faces joyful and expectant. "You did it!" Jasmine is laughing, hugging her emphatically so that Alex steps obligingly to the side. "You bloody did it, you rock star. Oh my God, I do not know how we got through that last half hour. My heart. Did you know what you were doing to me? I thought I was going to pass out 50 times. She shepherds them into the kitchen, closing the front door and bolting it. "Honestly, Nish, when you were sending me those texts, I didn't know whether to laugh or have a bloody panic attack with you." Nisha has been so locked into the quiet pleasure of her walk with Alex that it takes her a moment to switch to their frequency. "We're having champagne," says Andrea, who is pulling the top from a bottle. "Well, Prosecco, I didn't have the money for champagne, but it's basically the same." There is a whoop, and Jasmine is reaching into one of the cupboards for the glasses, while Grace busies herself emptying the family bag of crisps into a large bowl.
Do another bowl as well, baby. Those tortilla chips, the cheesy ones. Shall I get dips? Anyone want dips?
Alex and Andrea make their introductions over the music Jasmine has put on. Grace hands round the bowl of crisps, sneakily taking some for herself with each one offered. Jasmine hugs Alex 2-3 times, quizzes him about where they ended up, and her gaze slides sideways knowingly towards Nisha when he tells her. The little room is full of noise and relief and laughter. Nisha takes a sip of the Prosecco. It is cheap, too sweet, and absolutely delicious. She spies Sam, who is standing as she habitually does, in the corner of any room. She is watching them all with a vague smile, but there is sadness, wariness around her eyes. Nisha walks through the others, around the table, and up to her. The room falls abruptly silent. She sees Sam stiffen slightly, as if braced for whatever new verbal projectile is going to be hurled at her. They lock eyes. Thank you, Nisha says. Thank you for what you did. And as the others watch, a little disbelieving, Nisha takes a step forward and hugs Sam, pulling her in tightly, hanging on until she feels the other woman soften and tentatively, but surprisingly tightly, hug her back. Like the best impromptu parties, this one takes place with minimal effort. The Prosecco is drunk, and Alex nips out for some wine. By 9:30 that evening, there is music and conversation, and the little flat has become a haven of warmth and laughter. Andrea, whose recovery seems to have gained momentum since her hospital appointment, insists Nisha tell them every second of her time in room 232 and cries laughing, wiping tears from her eyes and dislodging her head wrap. Jasmine gives a blow-by-blow account of what she was feeling at every point, imitates the managers trying to work out who had set off the fire alarm. It had been put down to a troublemaker coming off the street, just one of those things that happen in a hotel in the centre of the city. She congratulates Sam on wearing her hood inside the hotel, and Sam doesn't have the heart to tell her that she had only done so because she had forgotten it was up. They consider the Frobishers, hauled abruptly from their sexy interlude. Don't tell that story again, Nish. I will actually wet myself. Who will even now be discovering the printed screenshot Nisha left in their room of Liz Frobisher dumping a cat in a bin.
They'll think it was cat vigilantes.
Grace is hysterical with laughter. And if they do have the brass neck to complain about the missing shoes after that, they're going to find they aren't even registered as guests, says Jasmine. What hotel is going to take seriously a claim of theft from someone illegally occupying one of their rooms? Someone goes out and gets chips, which they eat from a plastic mixing bowl, dipping them in a pot of tomato ketchup. Sam, watching from a footstool in the corner, is struck by the change in Nisha. She is altered somehow, softer, more relaxed. She sits behind Alex on the little sofa, and occasionally, when they think nobody is watching, they link fingers without looking at each other. It makes Sam sad. I have lost this, she thinks. I had it, and I lost it. Now that she has done the thing she had promised to do, her drive and determination have gradually leached out of her. She has helped Nisha recover her shoes, but she has lost everything. The evening swims and blurs, hours pass in minutes. They are, Sam realizes, all quite drunk, and she cannot bring herself to care. Kat is staying at Corinne's, having texted to tell her baldly an hour earlier, and informed that she has taken the dog, in case you had forgotten about him. Phil is gone, and she has nothing to go home for. She feels Andrea's hand on her arm. You okay, my darling? Fine, she says, trying to muster a smile. Andrea's eyes search hers. We'll talk later, she says, and pats her reassuringly.
Can I see the shoes? Says Grace.
What?
I want to see what all the fuss was about,
Grace announces again over the music. Alex smiles and reaches for his bag.
Sure, he says. Let's celebrate the prize.
Nisha looks suddenly unsettled. She waits as Alex extracts each red high heel from his bag, and he hands them to her carefully. She places them in a neat pair on the coffee table in front of her.
"They're really pretty," says Grace, and Jasmine squeezes her shoulder.
"Mad, isn't it?" says Andrea. "All that for one pair of shoes." It takes Sam a moment to register the way Nisha is staring at them.
"Do you know what's weird?" Nisha says. "I don't even care."
"Don't care about what?"
Jasmine turns down the music.
"The shoes. Look at them."
They look at the shoes, and then, with less certainty, at Nisha.
"They're a game to him, a way to keep me running around. I think I actually hate them."
"They are the perfect summation of our marriage. I'll show. Me running around after him like a fool, dressed like a fucking show pony, him pulling the strings. You know, my son thinks they're not even real Louboutins."
"But you've got them now," says Andrea reassuringly, "and that means he has to give you what you've asked for. He has to give you a settlement."
"No," says Nisha. "There's something off here. I don't get why he would be so obsessed with one pair of shoes."
"It doesn't matter why he wants them," says Alex. "A deal's a deal. You've done your bit."
Nisha holds one of the shoes, suddenly angry, then puts it down again.
"I mean, what the fuck is this? I was married to him for almost 2 decades, bore his son, gave my life over to his, gave him everything he wanted. I lost the best friend I ever had because he said I shouldn't be friends with someone like her, and I let him persuade me. I let him tell me who I should be friends with. And after all this, he humiliates me by making me run around after a pair of my own shoes."
Sam stares at the glossy shoes, at Nisha's contorted face. The atmosphere in the room has changed suddenly, the joy of the past hours evaporating. Jasmine and Andrea exchange glances. Nobody seems to know what to say.
"They don't even fit her, you know, if that's why he wants them. She has clown feet, actual clown feet. I hate them," Nisha says, "almost as much as I hate him."
"Babe, sit down," says Jasmine, reaching an arm out.
"You're spinning out. It's okay."
Nisha looks down at Alex, who is still sitting. His face is full of sympathy, of understanding.
"The shoes mean nothing," he says soothingly. "They are nothing, just a means to an end. Think about your future, what they will win you. This is all that matters."
"Get her another drink, Alex," Andrea says.
"I don't want another drink."
Nisha stares at the shoes, sitting on the coffee table. And then, almost on impulse, she picks one up, turns it over carefully in her hands. She looks at them, her face dark.
"Babe?
Seriously," Jasmine begins.
"He said I had to bring in the shoes, right? That was the deal. But he didn't say they had to be in one piece."
Before anyone can stop her, amid the shouted protests, "to stop, stop," she's wrenching at the shoe, pulling at it, bracing it over her knee until with a crack, the heel comes off in her hand. And out of it spills a glittering shower of diamonds. The room falls completely silent.
"What the fuck?" says Jasmine.
Nisha stares at the hollow heel in shock, and then at the floor. Alex is the first on his knees. He carefully scoops up a small handful of the tiny gemstones and deposits them one by one on the coffee table, where they sit, glinting under the overhead light, dotted with carpet fluff and tortilla crumbs. Nisha makes to speak, but no sound comes out.
"Okay," says Jasmine, tilting her head to one side. "Well, I guess he really did want the shoes."
A group of kids are wheeling their bikes up and down the walkways outside Jasmine's apartment, catcalling to each other and dropping firecrackers on the paving. One has a small moped, and occasionally Nisha hears the roar of its engine and the thunk, thunk, thunk of its rider taking it down a small flight of concrete steps, the squeals of occasional girl passengers. Normally, this would have left her wild with rage, but tonight she barely registers it. She lies in the narrow bunk bed, her mind humming as she thinks about the ramifications of what was in the shoes, the discussions they had in the last sober hour before everyone left. Everything has become horribly clear to her now. The way Carl would insist she wear them as they travelled between countries, even though they were frankly uncomfortable for flying. His rage when he discovered they were no longer in her possession. He had used her like a mule. How many times had she unwittingly transported gems for him? They had prized off the other heel, and there were more diamonds in the left shoe. None of them knew their value, but she guessed it was in the region of hundreds of thousands of dollars, perhaps more. The diamonds are a good size, beautifully cut. The largest is the width of her thumbnail. They had no magnifying glass in the tiny apartment, but she would bet on superior clarity. Oh my God, babe. There's your settlement. Jasmine had placed her hands on her knees, leaning forward to gaze at them. There is your settlement. Andrea had murmured to herself, it's like a story. Now you can tell him to get stuffed. She thinks of the trips to Africa they had taken over the past few years, other pairs of shoes he has bought her, dark blue Gucci Courts, cream Prada platforms. Had any of these been altered in the same way? Had she been an unwitting mule every time? Were these blood diamonds? Stolen? Contraband? And here is the worst of it. She, the ignorant courier, could have been caught at any time. Arrested. She has meant less than nothing to him. How could any husband care about someone he would use in that way? She climbs out of her bunk, taking care not to wake Grace, and pulls on the old lavender dressing gown she has become used to wearing. It smells comfortingly of Jasmine's home, her fabric conditioner. It is almost 2 a.m. She makes her way to the living room and quietly opens the door onto the balcony where she lights a cigarette. She checks the time, then dials a number. Ray? Hi, Mom. His voice is low, ominously quiet. Are you okay? There is a short silence. She takes a long, anxious drag on her cigarette. Ray, are you okay? He doesn't answer for a moment.
Yeah.
You don't sound good.
I don't want to be here anymore, Mom.
It's not much longer, I promise. Emily and Sasha left and it's just me and the eating disorders. Everyone else is going home at weekends. I just watch TV on my own.
I know.
He gives a long sigh. You're going to say you're not coming yet, aren't you? She closes her eyes. Soon, baby. I have the shoes. I do have the shoes. Things are happening, and I have some things to discuss with your father about the settlement. Then I will come and get you.
I feel like...
His voice is soft, resigned.
I feel like you're never coming.
Why would you say that?
When I was ill, that time you said you were going to come, and Dad made you go to Toronto. I was so sad, Mom, and you guys just went to Toronto. You just took his side.
She remembers the journey, how she had wept on the plane, and Carl had become steadily more irritated and said that all teenagers got moody. She and Ray needed to be less sensitive, and the boy was in the best place with the psychiatrists and people who could deal with that stuff. He had already raised two teenage boys with his first wife. He said it had been the same with them, and they'd grown out of it, and the worst thing you could do was keep fussing around them, and she had believed him. Even though his adult son seemed to despise him unless they wanted money, she had actually believed him. What had she known about good parenting after all?
Ray,
listen to me. Just give me a couple of days more, okay? I promise. Even if everything goes wrong when I speak to your father, even if I have to go get another passport and borrow money from my workmates for a plane ticket, even if I have to swim the damn Pacific, I will come get you.
It's the Atlantic.
That too. He lets out a reluctant laugh. And I'm a fast swimmer. You know it.
I hate my life. I hate living like this. It feels like nobody wants me and I've just been dumped here.
None of that is true. I am coming, baby. A long silence. She closes her eyes and drops her head onto her knees.
I love you so much, sweetheart. Please hang on in there. I won't let you down again, I promise. It's just going to be you and me together from now on.
She can hear his breathing, the million unwelcome thoughts whirring around his head.
Want me to sing for you again?
She says, when she cannot bear the silence any longer.
You are my sunsh—
Not really, he says, and ends the call. And then, before the sense of panic can set in, her phone pings.
Yes, this is still my number.
Juliana. Chapter 33.
Hey,
Nisha swallows.
Thank you for picking up.
It's fine, I'm just surprised. How are you? Juliana's voice is polite, wary, the way she used to speak to their employers, all the Brooklyn girl ironed out for something professional, something acceptable. She remembers how Carl used to talk about Juliana, how Nisha shouldn't be hanging out with a maid now they were married, how she was too coarse, too uneducated, a bad influence, his fury when she insisted Juliana was to be Ray's godmother instead of one of his moneyed friends. What he meant, she understood now, was that Juliana was simply too poor.
Listen, I don't know how much credit I have on this phone, but I have a favor to ask.
Juliana's voice hardens.
Right. Look, I know I don't deserve to ask you anything, but it's about your godson. It's Ray.
Ray? Is he okay? Juliana's tone switches immediately.
Not really. I know it's been a long time and it's a big ask, but I need someone I trust to check on him. I'm stuck in England. It's a long story and Juliana, he's really low. He's had some big problems, and some of them are my fault, and I need someone I trust to see him. To just, I don't know, tell him I'm coming, tell him it's going to be okay.
There is a long pause.
Tell me where he is.
He'll do it?
You have to ask.
And then Nisha is crying. The tears come out of nowhere. Tears of relief, of guilt, and release. She covers her face with her other hand, trying to wipe them away, to get her voice under control.
Really? You'd do that? After all this?
Text me the address. I'll go straight to him once I've finished work.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Nisha cannot stop. She is shaking. Will he know who I am?
Yes, we still talk about you.
I still think about him. All the time. Sweet boy. Nisha screws her eyes shut, her shoulders heaving as she tries to gather herself, to hide the emotion in her voice. They discuss a few details so that Juliana has an idea of where she's headed, what she might expect. She tells her, in bursts, that she is no longer with Carl, that she is doing everything she can to get back to her son. Juliana tells her in turn that she is married now, 2 children, 11 and 13, The fact that these seismic things have happened in Juliana's life, and Nisha knows nothing of them, causes something in her to constrict painfully. And then a recorded message tells her she has almost reached her credit limit.
I'll text you, okay? Juliana says, once I've seen him.
The feeling of relief is overwhelming. Juliana will do what she says she'll do, the most honest, the most straightforward person she has ever met. And then the tears come again.
I'm so sorry, Nisha says abruptly. You were right about everything. I've made such a mess. I missed you so much. I just got swept up in everything. I've wanted to call you so many times. I'm so sorry.
There is a long silence. She wonders briefly whether she shouldn't have gone there. What right has she to ask anything of Juliana after all? But when Juliana's voice comes back on the line, it is thick with emotion.
Me too. I'm here, baby, okay? I'm going to go see your boy.
Sam leaves Andrea's, where she had ended up sleeping, and walks the short distance home through the quiet morning streets. Her head is still buzzing with the conversations she and Andrea had the previous evening, the shocked acknowledgement of what she had been harboring under her feet. It made them laugh out loud. The randomness of it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. But every time Sam thinks about the kind of man Nisha had been married to, it makes her think of Phil. His kindness. His tenderness towards her. The insane idea that Phil would ever care so little for her that he'd have made her do something like that. She had seen this understanding dawn on Nisha's face while everyone else had been excited about her haul. And what Sam had seen, unnoticed by anyone else, had been sad and ugly. The final insult on an already steaming pile. After they left, she and Andrea had sat in Andrea's little front room until the small hours, high on adrenaline and conversation, and she had finally told Andrea about Phil leaving. Andrea had hugged her and said he would be back, of course he would. Sam checks her phone again, wondering whether to text him, but it's early in the morning and she has no idea what to say, or how honest to be. She wants things to be back to the way they were, when they had felt like a team, when it had felt like she was married to her best friend. Before his dad got sick and he lost his job and she developed a crush on the person who was listening to her. Was that even a reasonable thing to ask? Was it possible to resurrect a marriage when so much damage had been done? Of course it is, Andrea had said firmly. But she was twice divorced and four glasses of wine in, and Andrea loves her enough to tell her everything will be okay because she so badly wants everything to be okay for her. Sam turns into her street, noting how different it feels knowing she is walking home to an empty house. She wonders, dully, if this is how it will be from now on. No Phil. Cat increasingly absent until she, too, finally flies the nest completely. Even Kevin will not last for long. He is 13, positively geriatric in dog years. It will be just her, alone in that little house, watching the soaps and circling crappy jobs in the classified section of the local paper, being summoned twice a week to clean up for her increasingly crotchety parents. Stop it, she tells herself firmly. She stands still and breathes, in for one, hold for four, out for seven. Was it out for seven? Or should she be holding for seven? She hasn't done it for so long she can't remember. She forces herself to think about her unlikely group of new friends, the warmth of Jasmine, the way even Nisha had held her like she might be someone she actually cared about. She had helped Nisha get the shoes back. She had brought an entire hotel to a shuddering halt and changed someone's life as a result. She was capable of something, even if it was just chaos. She pauses in front of her house, looking up before she opens the gate, some part of her still hoping that a light might flicker on upstairs, that Phil might have decided to come home. And then she sees it, the faint glow in the upstairs landing. They never leave that light on when they go out. She walks up the pathway, suddenly full of anticipation, wrestles open the front door, and then stands blinking in disbelief at the shimmering fragments of glass, the broken chair, and her smashed television on the living room floor. Chapter 34 Cat? Sam is shivering in the garden. She had made her way through to the kitchen, her feet crunching on the mounds of upturned cereal and pulses, the smashed crockery, and had turned and walked rapidly back outside, suddenly fearful that the intruder might still be in there. She had waited outside for 10 minutes now, nothing stirring in the house, but she didn't feel safe in there.
Mum?
Kat's voice is bleary, fogged with sleep. Sam's hand goes to her mouth.
Oh, thank God. Why are you calling it 9:30 in the morning?
We've been burgled, love. I just didn't want you to come back here and find it. She doesn't tell her the truth. That she had suddenly been overwhelmed with fear that Kat might have been here after all, that this had been something so much worse than a burglary. What?
I know, it's a bit of a mess. Don't worry, we'll sort it out. Have you got Kevin?
Yep,
Oh, he's just farted, Kevin!
She lets out another breath. She can hear Kat struggling to sit up.
What did they take? Shall I come back?
I don't know. I've called the police, but no, stay there for now. I don't want you to see it like this.
Have you called Dad?
Sam stares at the front door, still slightly open.
I don't know if he'd want me to call.
It's fine. I'll sort it out.
Mum, I've got to go, sweetheart. I'll speak to you later. Don't come until I call, okay?
In the end, she sits in the camper van. It feels less awful than being in the house. She climbs into the passenger seat and stares through the windscreen, unsure what to do next. The police said they would send round an officer, but added that they were very busy and she would probably be wise to get a locksmith in and secure the property. There was no mention of dusting for fingerprints, or even any kind of investigation.
There's been a spate of them lately in your postcode, the operator says in resigned tones.
I wish you were here, she tells Phil silently. She calls Andrea, who says she is on her way. When she tells her friend about the mess, the damage, it hits her that this is real, not some strange fever dream. Her house looks like a war zone and she doesn't know how she's going to afford a new television. Before she hangs up, Andrea says, You don't think it's the shoes, do you?
What do you mean?
The break-in. Could it have been someone looking for the shoes? Sam goes cold. She heads back inside, suddenly completely alert. She walks with new eyes through the house, noting now how all the usual targets, televisions, iPads, are still there, albeit broken. But the house has been ransacked ruthlessly, every packet and box overturned and emptied, every drawer tipped out. When Andrea arrives, she is sitting on the front step, her puffy coat around her shoulders, holding her jewellery box on her knees. Everything is still in it. She knows the little gold trinkets are not valuable. Most are gold-plated necklaces, earrings Phil bought her back before Kat was born. But they are also proof that, whoever was in here, they were not opportunists or junkies trying to get enough for a fix. These intruders were looking for something specific. Sammy. Andrea is out of the car before the engine has stopped ticking, a soft woolen beanie in place of her usual wrap. She half walks, half runs up the path, and as Sam stands up, she embraces her. It is then, for the first time, that Sam feels overwhelmed and tearful. She feels herself giving in to Andrea's tight hug.
It's so awful in there. It's a complete mess, she says into her shoulder. I don't even know where to start.
Good job we're here then, isn't it?
Sam glances up and Jasmine is standing behind Andrea on the path, a large bag of cleaning materials in one hand and a roll of black rubbish sacks under her arm.
No point waiting for the police, babe. You got to be an oligarch or a politician to get police for a break-in these days. Believe me, I know.
Nisha climbs out of the rear car door, bringing with her a mop and bucket, and from the other side of the car, Grace emerges, trailing at the rear, carefully holding a cardboard tray of coffees with both hands.
Andrea called, Jasmine says. We swapped shifts to go in late. We figured this wasn't something you should handle alone.
She can't even speak. The relief she feels at the sight of them makes her knees go weak. Nisha stops and peers in through the front door. She stands, surveying it for a moment, then turns back to Sam. I hate him. I'm really, really sorry. Nisha is now an expert at tidying and cleaning messes, but there is something about this particular job that hardens her, tightens a muscle in her jaw as she sweeps and scrubs. She can see past the broken glass and splintered objects to the bones of the little house, a family home, steeped in love. Wedding photographs and badly framed family pictures are dotted around like no stylistic note mattered, just the fact of them being together. The worn sofa that speaks of a million comfortably cuddled up evenings, the faded children's paintings that nobody can face taking down from the hall. Carl has sullied this house. She crouches, sweeping up the tiny fragments of splintered glass, wiping spilled preserves from the kitchen floor, and thinks she has rarely hated Carl more. And she is an Olympic champion at hating Carl. It is one thing for him to punch out at his business foes, at her even. They were opponents who might stand a chance.
but to punch down on a little family that clearly has nothing, not even very much taste, she admits guiltily, is just mean. She can see from Sam's chalk-white face that she will no longer feel safe in this house, that the things that are broken will not be easily replaced. He has broken the most fragile thing of all, the sense of calm and sanctuary that a home should provide.
Oh my God!
Nisha looks up and Sam, a bin bag in her hand, is staring at her phone. Jasmine and Andrea are working upstairs and she can hear the vacuum cleaner whining as it is dragged backwards and forwards.
What?
Miriam Price, a woman I did some work for, just called, wanting to know why I hadn't confirmed with her about a job interview.
Okay, what did you say?
That I didn't feel like I could because I got fired and because of the whole, you know, theft thing. I didn't think she'd want to speak to me. I mean, she'd asked me to come in, but after that happened, I just didn't see the point, so I didn't bother to.
Yeah, but what? What did she say?
She wants me to come in for an interview anyway.
Nisha pulls a face. Well, that's good, right? You need a job.
Sam looks anguished. But it's today. Midday today. And look at me. I've been burgled. My house is destroyed. My husband has left me. I've barely slept in 2 days. How the hell do I do an interview today?
Nisha wipes at her face with the back of her sleeve. She puts down her mop.
Call her back. Tell her you'd be delighted.
Jasmine and Nisha pick out her outfit while she is in the shower. When she emerges, her hair wet and wrapped in a towel, her body draped in a cloud of self-consciousness, Jasmine is walking into her bedroom, bearing a newly ironed pale blue blouse on a hanger. Do you fit these? Nisha is holding up a pair of dark trousers.
I think so, she says. She has barely eaten in the last few days.
Okay, dark trousers and pale blouse, you can't go wrong. I found this jacket in your daughter's room. I think you'll fit it.
But your jackets are all awful.
No offense. This is Zara, but it looks more expensive. No, put that sweater down. You want to look like you have authority, not like you just escaped from a care facility.
Nisha holds up a pair of shoes Sam had worn to her cousin's wedding 3 years ago.
And these. But they're bright blue, and they're heels.
You need something to pop. The outfit is conventional. It shows you mean business first.
The shoes suggest there might be something slightly more interesting going on. The shoes say confidence.
Come on, Sam, get with the program. These people are going to be judging you from the moment you walk in. This is your armor, your calling card. You have to project.
When Sam looks hesitant, Nisha seems irritated. She puts the jacket down on the bed and says, "How did you feel when you wore my shoes?" Sam wonders if this is a trick question, but Nisha is waiting expectantly.
A bit awkward?
And
then powerful?
Right. Powerful. A force to be reckoned with. And how do you feel now? Look at yourself. Who do you see?
Not me.
You see a print sales executive person, or whatever the hell it is you do. You see a woman who has her shit together, who has it going on.
Sam sits as Jasmine begins to towel dry her hair.
Where is your makeup?
Bathroom cabinet, next door.
Yeah, I saw that stuff. No, your actual makeup bag.
That's it.
Both women stop what they are doing and stare at her.
Sam.
Nisha is stern. That stuff is old enough to walk itself out of your bathroom. Are you an actual savage?
Maybe.
You have nice skin though, babe. I can see you look after it.
Jasmine starts combing her hair through, spritzing it with one of Kat's many hair lotions.
I just use a bit of Nivea.
Both women laugh. Nisha nudges her.
Yeah, right, that's what the supermodels always say. And I stay so slim just by running around after my kids all day.
They collapse in gales of laughter. Sam, who really does use just a bit of Nivea, raises a weak smile and decides not to say anything else.
Half an hour later, Sam stands in front of the mirror in her now tidy bedroom.
Shoulders back, Nisha instructs her.
She stands taller and lifts her chin. Jasmine has blow-dried and tongued her hair so that it is voluminous and vaguely shiny.
Her makeup has been done by Nisha, who has magicked away the shadows under her eyes and done something to her lids so that they seem wider and more defined. She does not look like herself. She looks like someone who might be about to get herself a job. She raises a small smile.
Yes, says Nisha. There she is. There's our player.
Chin up and tits out, she says and turns to face them.
Not too much. That's a terrible bra. What?
Says Nisha, as Jasmine whacks her.
Just remember, Sam, Jasmine says, you're the woman who can bring an entire hotel to a halt. Power in those hands.
She points to her palm.
Yeah, there is, says Nisha, rubbing her arm ruefully.
I'm driving you, says Andrea. These guys are going to stay here and finish cleaning up.
Sam stands in her room, gazing at the three mismatched women. She looks suddenly uncertain again.
Don't be nervous, says Andrea. It doesn't matter if you don't get this one. Think of it as a practice run so you can get used to being in interview situations again.
But Sam still looks troubled.
Why would you do this for me? She blurts out.
Nisha pulls at one of Sam's lapels, straightening it. Because you helped me, and because, you know, you're an okay person. You're okay, Sam.
Sam's eyes have filled with tears.
But you've done so much, all of you. You've changed everything today. The cleaning up, the clothes, I've never had anyone be so...
Nope, says Nisha, firmly, taking her by the elbow and steering her out of the door. You are not getting sentimental, and you are definitely not going to spoil my excellent makeup by crying. Those eyeliner flicks did not get there by accident. Go, Andrea, go take her, go get the damn job. We'll be waiting.
Nisha, Jasmine, and Grace listen as Andrea's little car pulls away. When she is sure it has gone, Nisha stoops to pick up the smudged tubes and palettes of makeup that now litter Sam's bed.
My God, but that is a terrible duvet cover. What is it with these English women and their awful florals?
She looks up and Jasmine is smiling at her, a knowing smile, hinting at mischief.
What?
Jasmine looks at her daughter, then nods to herself.
You're a nice person.
What? No, I'm not. Get out of here.
She gathers up the last of the mucky little tubes, preparing to take them back to Kat's bedroom. Though she could do them both a favor and put the whole lot in the garbage.
You did a nice thing. There's a heart in there, and you can't help it showing up. Ugh, just clean up your stuff.
She's a nice person. Nisha's a nice person.
Grace and Jasmine's voices are sing-song and mocking. Over and over she tells them to shut up, but they are still singing it by the time they all go downstairs. An hour and a half later, Sam walks out of the Harlan and Lewis offices. Andrea is waiting in the car park, and she walks slowly across the tarmac in the unfamiliar shoes, her bag tucked under her arm. It is possible Andrea may have been dozing. She gives a little start as Sam opens the door of the Micra and climbs in, closing it with a thunk. Well? Sam kicks off the shoes in the footwell. She stares ahead, then turns to her. She looks like someone who has had several electric shocks.
I got hit, she says, her voice trembling slightly. I got the job.
They stare at each other.
Working directly to Miriam Price, and it's more money than I was getting at Uberprint. I start in a week.
Miriam Price leaves the office 5 minutes later. She walks past the blue Nissan Micra on the way to her car and sees two middle-aged women bouncing up and down in the front seats, hugging each other and shrieking like teenagers. She pauses to watch, smiles to herself, and turns away to find her car keys.
Chapter 35. Carl has tried to call Nisha 17 times, and every time she sees his name, she experiences something that may be hot or cold flash through her. She can't quite tell. She lies on the top bunk and stares at the phone buzzing silently and insistently in her hand and waits until it stops. Her not answering him will enrage him. You do not ignore Carl. He will know she has the shoes now because Ari saw her.
Alex has warned her not to answer it. It may give away her location, but it will only be a matter of time before Ari tracks her down. He had got as far as Sam's house after all. But she doesn't want to talk to him until she knows what to do. The others have told her she should keep the diamonds, start again somewhere else.
You'll be set for life. I bet they'll be worth loads more than he's offering you.
But she knows Carl. It won't even be about the worth of the gemstones. It's the fact that it will be unbearable to him that she has won any kind of victory over him. And here is her dilemma. If she keeps the diamonds, she at least has some kind of financial security. It is still possible he'll try to screw the deal and avoid paying her. But if she keeps the diamonds, he'll never leave her alone. He'll spend the rest of his life looking for payback. She remembers one of their circle, Rosemary, a furious, steely-eyed, betrayed wife who fought back in the courts until she was awarded an alimony settlement of more than $750,000 a year. Her ex-husband could easily have afforded it. It was basically his lunch budget. But instead, raging at the judge's decision, he refused to pay, circling the globe, shifting his assets, and running up year after year of legal costs, challenging the decision until, a decade later, she was exhausted and both of them were broke. Some men couldn't bear to lose at anything. She has walked that afternoon to a place in Hatton Garden where a man suggests they talk in his back office, doesn't ask where the diamonds came from, and says he can take them all off her hands for £80,000. From this, she deduces they're worth at least 10 times as much. She had seen him clocking her cheap jacket, his immediate assumption they were stolen.
"I can take them a couple at a time if that makes it easier," he said as she left.
The phone buzzes again. She stares at it. And finally she picks up. "I have the shoes," she says. "You'll have them when you show me my settlement." "You don't get to dictate terms. Those were your terms, Carl, if you remember." He is briefly silent. She can sense his barely suppressed rage at the other end of the line, and a faint shiver travels through her. "Where are you?"
"I'll bring them tomorrow," she says. "The hotel, downstairs in the lobby."
"Midday. I'm leaving straight after for the airport, so no games. If you don't turn up, you can stay here with no settlement and rot." He puts the phone down before she can respond. She still finds herself becoming a little shaky when she hears his voice. She lies there, regulating her breathing for a while, then shifts onto her side. She has tried Ray twice this evening, and he hasn't picked up. She is just about to send him another text when she notices Grace's collection of costume jewelry on her mirror, the strings of beads and fake crystals hanging from its corner. Anisha starts to think. Sam is wiping down the work surfaces in her parents' kitchen. This is not the straightforward job it would be at home, as wiping more than 6 square inches of the scarred, ancient formica involves moving jars, piles of paperwork, redundant milk cartons and spare batteries that may or may not have any life left in them, but won't be thrown away as it's bad for the planet to have them in landfill. It has taken her 4 hours so far to haul the house back into something resembling an orderly state, and she hasn't yet finished the kitchen.
"But why is Kat staying with Andrea? Is the house not secure? It's very worrying. I told your father ages ago we should get an alarm."
His voice echoes from the living room, where he is completing a 2,000-piece jigsaw that may or may not have been contaminated with pieces from the box above it.
"You said not to get an alarm as you didn't want it going off and making a racket. Don't be ridiculous, I wanted an alarm. You were too tight to pay for one."
Her mother had thrown her hands to her face when Sam told her about the burglary, her apparent delinquency in not cleaning for weeks briefly forgotten, while her mother considered this greater transgression. She had wanted to know everything. What they had taken? Nothing. Whether any of her neighbours' houses had suffered the same fate? No. Whether the police were doing anything about it? They still hadn't come, and appeared vaguely disappointed at all the answers.
"But if the house is secure again, why is Kat at Andrea's?"
Sam wrings out the dirty cloth in the sink. "Because Phil's not at home just now, and I didn't want her being alone there while I'm out." It had actually been Nisha's idea. They should both stay away for now, she said. Ari knew bad people. She had looked vaguely apologetic as she said it. Well, where's Phil? Oh my goodness, they didn't hurt him, did they? Is he in hospital? No, Mum. She pulls a face when she moves a jar and finds a large lump of mouldering cheddar behind it. He's gone away for a bit. Even when distracted by the prospect of violent crime, her mother possesses the laser instincts of a homing pigeon. Are you two still having problems? Sam puts the cheese into the bin and washes her hands under the tap, keeping her face turned away. He just needs to clear his head.
I told you, Tom, didn't I tell you? This is the problem when a woman works like you do. It is no good for a marriage. A man has to have a little pride, and by being the sole breadwinner, you have taken it away from him. Look what happened to Judy Garland.
Sam puts down the cloth. She rests her hands on the edge of the sink. You're thinking of A Star Is Born. And actually, Mum, he left because he thought I was having an affair with a work colleague.
Don't be ridiculous. Did you just throw that cheese into the bin? That's a waste. We could cut the ends off it.
Sam stays very still for a moment. Then she opens the bin, pulls it out from the rubbish, and places it in her mother's hand. Mum, she says, pulling off her apron, this is the last time I'm cleaning for you. I love you and Dad very much, but I'm about to start a new job which will be very demanding. In the limited time I have left to myself, I need to focus on my family. Or at least what remains of it, just as you advise. I have called 3 cleaning agencies, all of which have capacity, and now that the house is straight, I'm sure they'll be very happy to help you. Here are the numbers. The second, by the way, is the cheapest. It's possible that they use indentured labour, possibly Afghan. Maybe check with the union. Now, if you'll excuse me. She kisses her mother's stunned face, squeezes her father's arm, and picks up her coat from the chair, where one of them had dropped it on her arrival.
Lovely to see you both. Yes, I'm fine, thanks. Still a little shaken and frankly exhausted. Very, very sad about the end of my marriage, but nothing 4 hours of unpaid cleaning can't fix. Right, I'm off. I'll let you know how the new job goes.
She closes the door with a vigorous slam that she knows will annoy them, and doesn't look back as she leaves. Joel is already waiting in the cafe when she gets there. She sees his head dipped over his phone, and when it lifts at the sound of the door opening, his smile is tentative and gorgeous. She hesitates for a minute, then walks in and takes a seat at the wooden table opposite him. I got you a cappuccino, he says, pushing it towards her. I wasn't sure what you wanted. She smiles and takes a sip. Joel watches her and drums his fingers lightly on the tabletop. He has beautiful nails, even, neat and spotlessly clean. She wonders absently whether he files them. Maybe he gets manicures like Kat's friend Ben. She knows nothing about him, really. She could have projected all sorts of ideas onto him. For all she knows, he may have a passion for Byzantine lute music or a collection of antique dolls in his spare room. The thought makes her giggle and it turns into a sort of odd hiccup. What do they know about each other anyway? You okay? She straightens her face and swallows. I think so. You? Fine, fine. She takes another sip. So I had a talk with Marina, he begins, and we think we can get you your job back. She got some guidance from a mate in HR and apparently Simon should have given you a formal warning, and because we can prove you didn't actually steal those shoes, if we get that woman to write... Joel, I'm not coming back, she says. And then, I got the job, with Miriam Price. Joel's eyes widen a fraction. Harlan and Lewis? Whoa! He leans back in his chair, taking this in. He is wearing a shirt she hasn't seen before, and it stretches over his shoulders as he moves. I can't come back. She shakes her head. It's not a good place for me anymore. Not with... Her voice tails away. He considers this. His mouth purses at the corners and he nods. We can still see each other at boxing though, right? Across the cafe, a couple are dandling a baby on the father's knee. Its head wobbles with mirth as the mother blows raspberries at it. I don't know. She wants so badly to take his hand. She curls her fingers through the handle of the mug so that she cannot do it without thinking. I don't know what's happening with my marriage. But I have to try and I can't. This thing, She holds her coffee mug tighter.
I don't think I can see you anymore. I need to feel like a good person, and this makes me feel good, but it doesn't make me feel like a good person. Does that make sense?
And it's out there. The thing she has rolled through her head in her sleepless nights, an acknowledgement that there is something between them, and that whatever it is cannot continue. The only thing she has been able to hang on to is the sense that she can somehow be a good person again. She meets his gaze. It is sad and understanding, and makes something in her turn over.
Are you back together?
No, I don't know. She sighs. We've been married a long time. It's hard to just... I mean, he's not a bad man. It's hard to walk away from all that history without a backward look. I don't know. Maybe he already has. Maybe I need to be by myself and work out who I am without him. It's just hard when I've never really been without him.
They sit for a moment.
It's complicated, isn't it?
He nods.
It really is. I thought I'd have it all figured out by this age.
He lets out a short laugh, and then he looks serious again.
I hope he appreciates you, Sam. You're special.
I'm not. Not really. You're probably better off with someone less complicated.
But thank you for giving me...
He leans forward in his seat then and reaches across the table, his palm resting gently against the side of her face. He kisses her lightly and, just for a moment, lets his forehead rest against hers so that she can feel the warmth of his skin, their breath mingling in the space between them. They stay like that, oblivious to the gurgle of the coffee machine, the scraping of chairs and the sounds of the baby beside them, and she hears what she thinks might be a sigh. Sam places her hand over his and gently brings it down from her face, leaning back slowly in her chair. She gazes at his hand in hers and turns it over, surveying the scarred knuckles, the nails a few shades lighter than his skin. When she looks up, the smile they give each other is sad and true and filled with the things neither of them can say. Joel breaks the moment. He squeezes her hand briefly, then stands, releasing it. She is not sure what she can read on his face. Pride? Disappointment? Resignation? He turns and, without saying anything else, takes his jacket from the back of the chair, nods to her, and leaves. Sam drives the camper van along the narrow street to her house and parks at the front, noting that the builders have finally finished the adjoining wall. She needs to pick up more clothes for her and Kat, who seems to get through 3 outfit changes a day. They will move back in tomorrow once Nisha has sorted things out with Carl. But in the moment she allows herself to think about it, she doesn't know how she will feel about staying in this house. It still holds, in the unmoving air, the echo of the break-in, the occasional tiny crunch of something broken underfoot and lodged deep in the carpet. When she closes her eyes, she sees the devastation of her little home. It wakes her up at night.
"At least you have the terrifying guard dog," Andrea had said, looking at Kevin, legs splayed and snoring on her floor.
Not for the first time, Sam feels the loss of her old life like a wound. The world is full of lasts, she thinks. The last time you pick up your child, the last time you hug a parent, the last time you cook dinner in a house full of the people you love, the last time you make love to the husband you once adored, who will walk away from you because you turned into a crazy, resentful, hormone-fueled idiot. And with all these moments, you don't know that this will be the last, or you would be overwhelmed by the poignancy of them, hang on to them like someone crazed, bury your face in them, never let them go. Sam thinks about the last time she curled herself around Phil's body. If she had known it would be the last time, would she have done things differently? Would she have been more patient, less angry? If she thinks about the possibility that she will never hold him again, a hole opens up in her middle that leaves her feeling like she might just disintegrate. In for 6, hold for 3, out for 7. Sam steels herself as she reaches the front door. What would Nisha do? She would toughen up, be practical, strategize. So, she will head to John Lewis and replace the broken items tomorrow,
At least there will be money coming in again in a month's time. She'll live off credit till then. Perhaps at some point she may even have a little over to help Andrea. She flinches as she hears a sound from inside and stops in her tracks, slowly peers round the door, her heart racing. Carl Cantor's men. Her heart thumps all the way up in her throat. She feels a fine sweat break out on her skin. She creeps around the side of the house to the back door and reaches slowly behind the moss-covered garden gnome for the back door key. They must have broken in, but she can't see where. There are no obvious signs of forced entry. Of course there aren't. They are professionals, like Nisha said. But that doesn't mean they can just let themselves in. Adrenaline begins to course through her, and as she stands, listening to the sounds of movement inside, she finds that, instead of fear, she feels only cold fury. There is someone in her house. Her home. Treating it like it's theirs to walk all over, to take what they want. Well, they're not going to take anything else, and she's not going to be walked over anymore. Sam sees the cat in the bin, Simon smirk, her kitchen smashed and desecrated, her beloved family photographs trodden into the floor, the hours it took to get everything straight. Sam Kemp has had enough. She places her hand quietly on the handle, sees the shadow behind the glass door, and there he is, the man, bending down. To do what? Sift through what he has already wrecked? Finish what he started? Sam does not have a plan. She knows there are a million reasons why it will be unwise for her to interrupt the intruder who is in her house, but something in her body propels her with a roar that seems to come from somewhere in the pit of her stomach, pulls her right fist back, and with a jab that would have had Sid cheering, punches the intruder full in the face, sending him tumbling backwards onto the floor.
But what were you doing?
Putting things straight.
Phil's voice is muffled. He is still holding some screws in his left hand, and now, as she holds the ice pack against his nose, he drops them gently onto the coffee table. They leave indents on the skin of his palm, where he must have been clutching them too tightly.
Kat told me what happened. I came to help.
She'd like to know what else Kat has told him, but she doesn't want to ask. She takes the ice pack off for a moment and touches his nose where the bruise is already purpling, the small cut that she has carefully covered in Savlon. His face, so familiar and unfamiliar to her touch. She puts the ice pack back, desperate for something to do with her hands. It is then that she sees the television propped in the corner.
Oh, yeah. She told me they'd smashed ours, so I rang around the lads and asked if anyone had a television we could borrow. This one's Jim's. He said it lives in his garage because his wife prefers him to watch the racing out there. He's a bit noisy, apparently, when he has a horse coming in. I thought you didn't like asking your friends for anything. It seemed daft not to. It sounded like it was quite a mess.
Yes, she says. It was. He looks different somehow, even under the ice pack. She realizes he has shaved. He is wearing jeans instead of jogging bottoms and a fresh shirt. But there is something else. He seems less hunted, like he's more certain of the space he occupies.
Boxing training's working then,
he says, and touches his nose gingerly.
I'm so sorry, she says. If I'd thought for one moment it might be you, I wouldn't have. That was quite a punch.
She feels a little weak as the last of the adrenaline leeches away and sits heavily back on the sofa. They smile awkwardly. She looks at her knuckles. The middle one has gone a purplish colour and the skin is grazed where it may have made contact with Phil's teeth.
I didn't actually know I could hit that hard.
He looks at her ruefully.
Yeah, well, you always were stronger than you thought.
They sit for a moment, his words hanging in the air. Phil leans back beside her. He rubs his free hand over the top of his head. Neither of them looks at the other.
I messed up, Sam, he begins. You didn't mess up. Please, let me just say something. I messed up, I just lost myself for a bit, and I didn't want to admit it. But I've started on antidepressants, the happy pills. Apparently they should start kicking in soon.
He raises a small smile.
And I've been talking to someone.
A therapist.
Yes, me.
He says at her shocked expression.
I should have told you, but I knew you were worried about money and, well, I guess I just didn't. I didn't tell you a lot of things.
He sighs.
I don't know why, but I'm doing it now. I'm doing all the things.
Phil.
Sam. I don't know if I want to talk about what happened yet. I'm not sure I want to know, but you and Kat are my life. Spending a few days at my mum's, away from you both, I knew I'd made a terrible mistake. I don't blame you, Sammy. I don't blame you, whatever it was. I just know I want to be better. I want my wife back. I want us back. I want just to feel like I have a home again.
He swallows.
If I do still have a home.
She throws her arms around him then. She had listened to his words, one part of her thinking she should be reserved, maybe argue her case. But he's speaking and there's a sweetness to his face, a hopefulness and openness that makes something in her crack apart. She holds him around his solid waist, feeling his arms slide around her, his lips on her hair, and she thinks, this is where I need to be.
I love you so much, Sammy. I won't lose you again. I promise.
His voice cracks on the words.
You'd better bloody not, she says into his shirt.
She cannot let go. She may never let him go. They clutch each other, and she is aware suddenly of a rising feeling of gratitude and hope, two sensations that feel utterly, utterly unfamiliar. Maybe sometimes things do work out, she thinks, and it feels like a radical thought. They are still in this position when the door opens. They hear Kevin's bark before they see Kat, who is standing a little warily in the hall, looking at them through the living room door. Phil makes as if to move back, but Sam doesn't release him. She thinks she may stay here for the rest of her life.
I got us another telly,
Phil says when they cannot think of anything else to say. He gestures towards it.
Dad is fixing everything, says Sam into his jumper.
There is a short silence.
Oh no, does this mean I don't get two Christmases? Says Kat.
Bummer! But she's smiling as she strides down the little hallway to the kitchen.